Please help me welcome our speaker tonight, Valerie B. from Ringo's, New Jersey.
Hi, everybody. I'm Valerie, and I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is November 9th, 2000. My sponsor is Joy H., and my home group is the Ringo's Freedom Through Acceptance Group. It's really great to be here tonight. I really wanted to thank Dave and Rich for inviting me to come out and speak to you all tonight. It's really just a lovely drive up here. And I guess that I'll just start off by saying that I'm the youngest of four children, and I'm the youngest by far. My oldest sister is 20 years older than I am. So even growing up, I never really felt like I fit in anywhere, just not even with my family. My parents were in their 40s when they had me, and, you know, my sisters and my brother, they were all kind of friends with each other's friends, and I was just not a part of. And for whatever reason, that feeling of not being a part of was just a part of my makeup. And I can't really contribute it to anything that ever happened to me or anything that anybody ever did to me. I was really just a weird kid, and I was up in my head even at a very young age. I was obsessive compulsive. I just didn't really know how to interact with other people. So really, I sincerely believe that even in kindergarten, I remember just feeling different, and I carried this with me. When I was 11 or 12, I started to ride horses, and I just had a lot of really obsessive compulsive behaviors that defied any intellectual thought that I had. Intellectually, I would understand that I didn't need to do these behaviors, that what I was thinking was unrealistic, but I couldn't not do it. You know, I just got a sense of relief from just giving into the behaviors. And so really, from a very young age, I really struggled with the bondage of self, and you know, I have the language for that today, but certainly at that time I didn't have that language for what was happening to me in my mind. And when I was 14, I picked up my first drink. It was rum and coke, and I just loved it. I loved it because it stopped all that stuff that went on in my head. It was me and this girl that I grew up with since I was in second grade. She lived right down the road from me, and we did a lot of stuff together. And again, like, I had friendships, and I had relationships with people. I was probably with this girl almost every single day of my life, from second grade until I was about 16. And I still just never felt connected. And on this particular evening, I was sleeping over her house, and we were sneaking out so that we can go and drink, and these guys were going to pick us up. And I was just always attracted to anything that I should not have been attracted to. I was in high school at this point, and I took that drink, and I just loved it. I mean, there's just no other explanation for it. It kind of dimmed down all those other thoughts that went on in my head. And again, they weren't really conscious thoughts. Like, today I can see them as conscious thoughts, but at that time I didn't. I really just internalized them. And I really sought drinking as an escape right from that time on. I mean, my progression happened very quickly. I was probably only 15 or 16 when somebody taught me, you know, if you want to get rid of a hangover, just wake up and keep drinking. And that was really what I did. And my life just, it revolved around alcohol. And to add to that insanity, when I was 14, my father suffered a really just completely unthought of accident. He just fell down some stairs in an ice storm, and he damaged his spinal cord, and he became partially paralyzed from the waist down. So when you take all that stuff that's already up in my head, compounded with a life-altering event and a kid that has no coping skills to be able to communicate how I was feeling or to be able to deal with the changes that were happening in my life and my fears, and knowing that alcohol was a great escape, it was a collision that was just, I don't see how anything else could have happened to me in my life. I really believe that if I wasn't introduced to the alcohol and the other substances that I was introduced to, I really probably would have killed myself. And And I did. I drank. And my parents, of course, because my father was in a hospital probably for about a year between being in a trauma center, and then he went from there into a physical therapy place for, 6 to 9 months. And so they weren't really watching me. So this is how I start to get away with a lot of really negative behaviors. And I was just that kid with the headphones on, with the music way up, and just don't talk to me. Don't talk to me, don't touch me, don't try and interact with me, just leave me alone. And that was really how I went through the next few years of my life. And by the time that my parents realized that there was something wrong with me, I was in full blown, I was, drinking and using every day. And by the time that I was 19, I was in jail. And this is my first introduction to Alcoholics Anonymous. My parents had tried to put me into counseling, and, the reality of it was, I remember I would sit there with this counselor, and I would say, today I'm going to tell her the truth. I'm going to tell her that I really can't stop drinking, and I don't know why I can't stop drinking, but I want to stop drinking, and I can't. And I would go in there, and I would have it all planned out as to how I was going to tell her the reality of what was happening with me. And I would go in there, and she would ask me how I was doing, and I'd say, I'm fine. And, I'd throw her a bone. I would talk about, some of the awful fights I would get into with my boyfriend, because, obviously she knows that there's something screwed up about my life, or I wouldn't, be seeing her. And so, I'd kind of tell her what I thought she wanted to hear, but I would not tell her that I was drinking and using as much as I was drinking and using. It just could not come out of my mouth, no matter how much I wanted it to. And the truth is that I hit many bottoms before I ended up getting sober at 21. And, they were just places of despair. And it's really only been in this past year that I've even been able to understand what I did in my active alcoholism. And, I was in a god-awful relationship. It was very violent, and it was very abusive. And then it's really just recently that I saw the bottom line to my behaviors, and the people that I chose to be with was just destroy me. Just annihilate me. Take me off this earth. If the alcohol and the drugs can't do it, then somebody else better do it for me. And I was with people that were just like me. They wanted to be destroyed too. And I was all about it, And like I said, it's taken me 9 years to really understand that that's what I was looking for. Just take me out of this. And there was one point where I tried to get sober on my own. And this is when I was about 16. This is even going back a little bit. I was 16, and some of the friends that I was hanging out with started to think that I was kind of having a little bit of problem with the way that I was drinking and the way that I was partying. So I decided to stop, and I developed a really awful eating disorder. Again, I had nothing to look forward to. I would go to work, and the minutes would pass by like hours. I was trying to do good in school. I was trying to be responsible. I was trying to be constructive, and it was not fulfilling to me. And this is where, when I get introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous for the first time when I'm in jail, this is my snapshot of sobriety. So this is really important, that I did try to get sober, and it was just torture. I was crawling out of my skin. And I had no ability to communicate this to anybody else. I was just up in my head, and I was just going out of my mind. And I had nothing to look forward to anymore at the end of the day. At least before, it was like, if I can just get through this 8 hours of work, at least I can go home and drink. And so this is, this is really where I think that sobriety is going to take me. And, it's like it talks about in the big book. I can't imagine living with it, and I can't imagine living without it. And that's really where I was. I knew it was destroying me. And, by the time I was 19, it really had stopped working for me. But I didn't have any other way out of the insanity that was my head. And it was a really painful place to be. So I go to jail, and I was in jail for a few months. And I was in there with other people, and they were really the ones who were telling me that I should go to AA. And I thought that that was really kind of comical. These were girls that were about my age. They were in their, you know, 19, 20, 21. And they were in the same place as I was. So I was kind of like, I don't think AA works so well for you if you're here with me. And, but they did. They told me that was really how I kind of got, introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I went to meetings when I was in jail. And the first speaker that I ever heard, it's really kind of neat because years later, when I would end up getting sober, she was one of the first people that I saw when I started coming back into the rooms. And that was really neat because I really remembered what she had said. And I can't emphasize how important I think it is for people to take commitments into institutions and jails, because certainly at that time I didn't get it. I don't know that I was capable of getting it or capable of hearing what she had to say, but I sure remembered her. And it definitely planted a seed. So I go from jail. From jail, they mandate me to a rehab. And in rehab, they start talking about the obsession to drink. And I honestly have no idea what they're talking about. I have no idea. I'm just thinking that it's like a thought that you think over and over and over again. And, ironically, I just did not identify. And I didn't identify with a lot of stuff, but I did. I mean, I introduced myself as an alcoholic because it didn't seem like the wrong thing to say. It, I knew that when I put a substance into my body, I knew I couldn't stop. I would physically go into withdrawal, and I no matter what, I just couldn't stop. I knew that about myself. But the rest of it I didn't identify with. And really, I didn't. So I'm in this rehab, and I actually ended up using while I was in rehab, and that was another one of those things. Like, I don't know that I had a conscious plan. It just kind of happened, it just kind of happens when I don't have some power greater than myself standing between me and that drink. And I went from rehab, I went to this halfway house in Florida, and it was really like a sober living environment. I had an apartment with two or three other women. I went to work, and I gotta tell you, I felt better than I had ever felt. I mean, I was physically detoxed from all of the myriad of substances that I had in my body, and by the time that I was in jail, I was detoxing from at least two or three substances. And I feel physically, I feel really good. And I was with a bunch of women who I really enjoyed being around. And we had a good time, and we played a lot of cards. And I just felt good. And I didn't really think that this stuff applied to me. I thought maybe I was just young. I went through a bad phase. And, I mean, I went to meetings because we had to. And I didn't get a sponsor. Some woman there had given me this phone number, and it was always busy. So she said, you just give them, this is the phone number of your sponsor, and every time that they try and call, it's going to be busy. So you don't really have to get a sponsor. So that's what I did with that. And I go through this, and we can date and stuff, so you can see where this is going. I find my new higher power. I meet this guy. And I ended up, when I relapsed, the truth of my relapse was that I wasn't thinking about taking a drink that day. I wasn't. It just happened to be presented to me, and I just did it. And no matter what, I could not get sober after that. I went on a run for another 6 to 8 months. And I just, as soon as I started the detox, those thoughts would come in. You know what? You'll feel better if you just go. You'll feel better if you just go. All this physical and mental pain, it's going to stop in 2 seconds as soon as you pick up a drink. You don't have to worry about any of this anymore. And my head was just screaming at me. And physically, I felt awful. But, even worse is that mental kind of anguish that goes with it. Just remembering all the good times that I had and how could I ever leave this behind. And I would just succumb to that obsession. And I would just drink. And I was checking myself into detoxes at the time because my behavior was totally, completely out of control. I was really afraid of what I was doing and what I was becoming. And I couldn't stop. No matter what. And I always really thought, you know, if I could just get into another detox, I could always go back into the rooms when I want to. And that is just not my experience. And I feel very blessed that I had that experience. Because I see a lot of people that go back out, and that's what they say. I'll come back if it gets bad enough, and I'm really an alcoholic. And by the grace of God, I know I couldn't make it back. And the reality for me was I went back to my parents' house. There's like this outpatient drug and alcohol counseling place that I had gone to previously. And they weren't going to fund me to go into another detox. But it just so happened that I had taken something that was laced with something, and I was talking to walls and people that weren't there, and they really thought I was about to die. And I still left. Like, as soon as I started the detox, I left my parents' house. But they set it up so that I could get into this detox. And, you know, I left. I went on another run. And by the grace of God, and today I know for me that it was the grace of God, one day I made it to that detox. And I knew at that point that it wasn't me that did it, that I didn't have a choice, that there really was something greater than me that brought me to that detox. And while I was in that detox, I had a counselor, and she said something that really changed my life. And at this point, I mean, I had been to jail, I had lots of legal issues, I was in a really insane, very violent relationship, as I said before. I didn't have a whole lot left. And she said to me, you know what, if you want to get sober, then you have to do it for yourself, but you have to make a decision. Because the truth is that nobody in this detox gives a shit about you. Your parents don't expect you to get sober. Your boyfriend is going to prison. So you know what? If you don't want this, I really don't care. Just go. Go back out and drink. That's your choice. But if you want to get sober, don't feed me this crap about going to another rehab and going to another halfway house. Go back to your parents' house and go to Alcoholics Anonymous or Narcotics Anonymous or wherever you want to go. And get sober. But this is something that you need to do, because it's not the state of New Jersey telling you to do this. This isn't your parents. This is about you. And she really made me very upset when she said that. And I went back to my room, and this was the first time that I really think I understood the third step. But I didn't know what the third step was at that time. But looking back on it now, I can kind of see where I really had a very powerful third step experience. I went back to my room and I felt like something loved me. And I think that I had had that experience before, but I just kind of dismissed it. And I didn't really let it impact me. I just thought that it was just another emotion that would be fleeting, that was kind of meaningless. And I had always, always struggled with God. And again, this had nothing to do with my upbringing. My parents are very religious people. And the God that I got from their religion is very different than the God that they got from their religion. They do not see God as I learned it. And I don't attribute it to even the religion. It's my perception of what I learned. And I have two sisters and a brother who came from the same parents and had the same kind of upbringing, and they have a completely different concept of what they learned than what I did. And so I was sitting there and I just had this feeling like something loved me, and I chose to accept that feeling as being a higher power. And from there I did make a decision. I said, you know what, I am going to go back to my parents' house. And I am going to give AA a try. And the worst case scenario is it doesn't work, and I can go back and do what I was doing, you know. And because the reality for me, I didn't even, you know, I know a lot of people who come in and they have some preconceived notions of AA, and I really didn't. There were a lot of different ways that I heard of getting sober, and I really didn't discount any of them. It was just that I had seen people that failed from every aspect of them. So I didn't really have any expectations, or I didn't have anything. I was just going to do it. I was just going to take a chance, take a suggestion, and just do it. While I was on my way to my parents' house, the detox that I was in, they drove me. And they had to stop someplace to pick somebody else up. And it just happened to be in a neighborhood where I used to hang out all the time. And I knew that if I just went a couple blocks down the road, I could end up getting anything that I wanted. And I had a plan. I had a plan, and I didn't want it there. It was just there. I wasn't consciously trying to think of it. And I was really scared. I had this moment of clarity where I saw that there is nothing that I am not capable of doing when this disease is running my life. And I was terrified of the person that I could become if I kept doing this. And the reality of my sobriety today is when I stand in judgment of people, and I recently, there was this girl that was put in my life, and it wasn't through Alcoholics Anonymous, but it was through a different route, and she had done something that was, you know, pretty awful to a child, and I, at first I was kind of disgusted, and then I was like, you know what, I can't be disgusted, because the reality for me is I am capable of anything once I put the drink or the drug into my body. And as long as I think that I'm different from any cruel and unusual human act, I'm not going to stay sober. That is how I understand my disease. That when I'm drinking, I really do not know what I will become. And one of the gifts that I have is understanding that people do things because they're really sick. And like I said, sometimes I like to think that I'm different from those people. And sometimes it is hard. And I work in a profession where I see people do some pretty sick things. But I do. I have to bring it back to, well, what if you were 19 with two screaming children and no support? And, you know, didn't have the tools that I have today. Who knows what I would do? And that's my reality. So in this moment where I'm terrified because I know that I'm going to end up drinking again. And I make it back to my parents' house, and nobody was home when I went back to my parents' house. And I still had a plan. I was going to steal a car, and I knew where there was some money that I could get, and I had all these plans of how I was going to end up drinking again. And I didn't know what to do. Like, I was like, oh, I could call my sister, but my sister's a cop. I really don't think she's going to understand what I'm going through right here. And the only thing that was left was just me and a higher power. And I hit my knees that day, and I just asked God what I needed to do to help myself. And I ended up at an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting that night. And believe me, that's no brilliant brainstorm that I have. It's just not. I wish I could say it was. But that wasn't where I was looking to end up. And I went to this meeting, and there was somebody there who I used to drink with and party with all the time. And he was there because he was on parole, but he was sober. And that was really hard for me to believe. And he told me about this life where he got up in the morning and he took a shower and he ate breakfast and he went to work and he went to a meeting. And I was like, wow. Because again, I knew I was going to drink again. It wasn't if, it was when. And we encouraged me to, you know, get a sponsor and join a home group and all that kind of stuff. And I really thank God that he was there, because seeing him there, I mean, it's one thing, you know, I looked at the people in the rooms, I didn't really think that they had ever been through or experienced what I had been through and experienced, but I knew that he had, and I knew that he was sober, so I really did think that maybe there was some hope for me. And, you know, my reality in my early sobriety was that I did reach out to some women, and in that area, the women weren't very receptive, and I was really starting to get discouraged. And I went to this meeting one night, and this woman actually came up to me, and she said, she asked me if I was new, and I said that I was, and she said, well, I'm Jessica, do you have a sponsor? And I said, no, and she said, I'm going to pick you up tomorrow night, and we'll talk. And, you know, later on she told me, she said, you just look like you were going to die. You really look like you were just dying. And it's funny, because I didn't see that at the time. But I recently saw a girl who was about my age, and I mean, she just looks like she's dying. I mean, she's so pale, she's so thin, she's so frail. The desperation is just all over her. And I guess that she saw that in me, and she really just embraced me. And the reality of my coming in here was that I had been homeless in Florida. I had bug bites up and down my entire body. I would get messed up. I would scratch them open. They were all infected. I had bruises from fighting with my boyfriend. I had track marks up and down my arms. I was jaundiced because I had some liver issues. I was not a pretty sight. I just wasn't. I couldn't read when I came in here. One of the stories that I like to tell is, because this is just so descriptive of what I was, my parents had given me, they were letting me drive one of their cars to meetings because they didn't want to drive me around, and they just kind of figured, like, if I was going to drink again, they were going to find out about it pretty quickly, and they would just throw me right back in jail, because they were actually the ones that had insisted that I stayed in jail when I went to jail, because they really thought that I was going to die, and they had the charges pressed against me, and I had certainly committed the crime, but, you know, they didn't really put up with that kind of behavior from me. So I'm driving their car, and, you know, one day it breaks down, and, I call my parents, and my dad's like, have you forgotten it? And I was like, oh, I totally forgot that you were supposed to put gas in the car, which wouldn't be so bad if I didn't work at a gas station. So this is really what I am in early sobriety. I mean, I have no capacity to function. I really don't. And that was a blessing. I was so sick. I was so weak that I really didn't even have the energy to think about how I was going to end up anywhere. And I had a really psycho ex-boyfriend who kept coming back to New Jersey to try and find me. And I also realized very recently that part of the problem with that whole situation was that I never actually broke up with him. So I was complaining because he kept trying to find me in New Jersey, but he really didn't know. I just kind of thought that he should assume that I broke up with him, but I never actually communicated that with him. So this is really, like, this is me in early sobriety, and I did not know what to do with myself. I had a lot of legal issues. I had health issues. I had, you know, the usual kind of insanity that people have when they come in here. And that woman, Jessica, who came into my life, she was the perfect person to come into my life, because she said, the only solution that I have for you is a higher power. The only thing I can tell you is to pray. I don't know what's going to happen with your legal issues. I don't know what's going to happen with your boyfriend. I don't know what's going to happen with your health. I do know if you go back to jail, you can be okay no matter what. And that we can be okay no matter what our circumstances are. But you have to do work to get there. And I was really attracted to that because I knew she wasn't lying to me. I mean, it talks in the big book about how we can hear a message of depth and weight. And that's what she had. There was no advice. There was no, you're going to be okay. There was just, I don't know, pray, work these steps, read the big book, come to meetings, and, you know, keep calling me, you know, get with women, and, you know, you'll have a shot. You'll have a shot at being okay no matter what. And I believed her. I just believed her, and I did what she told me to do. And the reality for me in my early sobriety, and this is how come I think she was such an integral part of me staying here, was I had a lot of behaviors that I couldn't just stop doing. I really could not just stop stealing or stop drinking or stop, you know, or stop talking to the boyfriend. I could not on my own willpower. And I also lied all the time, and I didn't know why I lied. I just did. I mean, if you asked me what I had for breakfast, and if I ate pancakes, I would have told you eggs. And I don't know. That was just how I functioned. Every word out of my mouth was just a lie. And one day I looked at her and I just said, you know, do you know that I lie about almost everything that I tell you? And she said, yeah, I figure that you do. And this woman, who was actually her sponsor, said, just ask God to tell the truth for you when you open up your mouth. Just invite God into that place. And very slowly I started to tell her about the people that I was hanging out with that were drinking, that I shouldn't have been hanging out with. I started to tell her about some of the stuff that I was doing that I really needed to get honest about, but was afraid to, because really I was in a place where I didn't feel comfortable with sober people. I mean, they were talking about, like, politics and, like, health issues and, like, all this other kind of crazy stuff, and I probably didn't even know who the president was at the time. But I wasn't really comfortable with people that were drinking either. I mean, I didn't really want to go back to that, and at the time I worked for my father, and he had a convenience store and a gas station. So I was with a lot of really interesting characters who did a lot of really interesting things, and I didn't fit in anywhere, and that was really how I felt. And then I tried a bunch of different places, and she just kept taking me through the work. And she would say, well, I'm not going to tell you not to do these behaviors, but I am going to tell you, go to the meeting tonight, do this step work, read this, do something constructive, and then, you know, keep working on this, keep getting, like, and she just told me that, like, we have to get to the root of our problems. Because I didn't know why I did the things that I did. I had no idea that I was self-centered. I had no idea that I'm driven by fear. It really took a lot of work for me to get to the heart of those behaviors. And I'm just really blessed that she was in my life and that she was able to just love me exactly as I was and just keep taking me through the steps and just kept telling me to pray. And I was also blessed to have the women that she had in her life, in my life also. She had a wonderful sponsor who I am still very in touch with and connected with today. And, you know, like, it meant a lot to me because she, at the time, was engaged. She had a nice condo. She had a lot of good stuff going for her. But she picked up me, and I was just the socially inept, you know, socially awkward, you know, like, there was nothing fun about me. Like, why would you go 20 minutes out of your way to pick me up and take me to a meeting when you could really stay at home tonight with your fiance and, like, do something interesting, you know, like, go out or, you know, watch a movie or something? Why are you picking me up? So it really meant a lot to me that this woman who didn't even know me cared enough to do so much for me, because I did lose my license about 6 months after I got sober. And she had me do that first step where I was, you know, admitted that I was powerless over alcohol. And it's interesting how this step has kind of changed over the years. I can really get with the importance of admitting. And again, the first time that I admitted that I was an alcoholic, I really just admitted it because it didn't seem wrong. Like, yeah, sure, I could be an alcoholic. Maybe I'm not. I don't know. But it seems like the right thing to say right here. So I'm just going to say it. And today, it's a whole other thing if I've got something in my head that I've been doing that I know is wrong. It's a whole other thing to keep that between me and God, and something entirely different when I admit it to somebody else. So that first part of that, just admitting that I'm powerless over alcohol, just admitting that I've done something that I really shouldn't be doing, it's huge. That is such an important first step. Whether it's in my heart or not, I really just believe that the power of admission that happens between one alcoholic and another is just life-saving. I really believe that. And like I said, I am not somebody. It is not easy for me to open up and talk to anybody. It's just not, even today. And I've been with my sponsor for a good... my first sponsor, she ended up moving, and I got another sponsor, and I've had her for about 6 years. And even with her, you know, today I have to invite God into that place and just say right here what I need to say to her, because I'm not capable of doing it myself. So like that first step, just that first, those first two words, the we of it, because I can't do this on my own, but just admitting that I'm powerless over alcohol and that my life is unmanageable, that those were, I just understood it, and I can't explain it. I just knew that I was powerless over alcohol. I knew what that obsession was. I knew that when I pick up a drink, I just turn into something completely different that I have no control over, and I totally knew that my life was unmanageable. But I had no idea what manageable looked like, so it didn't really have that much meaning to me. you know, yeah, everything was all over the place, and it was pretty awful. But I really didn't know what it would look like to be manageable. And then that second step, the first time I really understood that second step, coming to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. As I said before, I worked someplace, and there was a lot of people that were drinking and doing a lot of other substances there, and they would come into work and tell me all their war stories about stuff that they did over the weekend, and I would be all jealous, like, gee, I wish I could still drink, and I wish that I could drink like him, because, you know, he can just drink on the weekends, and I can't. And my heart would just hurt because I couldn't do what these people were doing. And then one day, this kid sat down next to me, told me about some party that he went to, and I don't know, there were swords and machetes coming out, and like all kinds of crazy stuff, and I was like, thank God I don't live that way anymore. And with no thought on my part, I saw the loneliness, I saw the hopelessness, I saw the desperation. I heard something completely different than what I had heard before when people tell war stories. And I did. I just saw him in a completely different light. And that, to me, was how I understood and continue to understand being restored to sanity. When my will is really clashing with what seems to be indicated as God's will, and I'm fighting that, and I'm in that, and I'm in pain because I'm not getting what I want, when I let God into that place, and however is indicated for me today, whether it's sponsoring somebody or going to an extra meeting or whatever it is, my perception of a situation changes. Through no biting, screaming, kicking, or scratching on my part, my perception just changes. And instead of seeing how much fun this person is having with drinking, I see somebody who's really in pretty bad shape. And I hung on to that because I was like, wow, like I saw that I understood something that I didn't understand before. And then that third step, like I said, I really think that third step really happened for me when I was in that detox. I made a decision that I was going to go to a meeting. And at that point, who knew whether or not I was actually going to make it there. But I did make a decision that I was going to go back to my parents' house and actually give this a try. And I did. I just was willing to believe that something loved me. And that had to be my higher power. It just had to be something that was loving. I couldn't have the judging, unforgiving, harsh God that I had before. It really had to be something that was bigger and stronger than that. And today, when I get that God of tricks, I have to fire it and get another higher power that's even stronger than that. Because I can go right back there and say, well, yeah, I'm going to get all this good stuff, and it's going to get torn down, and this is going to happen, and God's going to test me, and I have to let go of that higher power and just get a new one. That fourth step where I look at the people that I've harmed. The first time that I did a fourth step, I really just did it because I didn't want to drink. I was like, all right, fine. I'll write this fourth step. And there were people I had to make amends to right away because there were some legal issues involved. And I would just do whatever my sponsor told me to do. But it was the first time that I really started to understand why I was doing the things that I was doing. You know, and really came to understand, like, oh, this is out of fear. And I'm selfish. I had no idea that the reason that I was so afraid of people was because I was up in my head all the time. No, I couldn't have a conversation with you because I was always thinking about myself. I was completely incapable of hearing anything else anybody said to me. It's not that I was thinking anything good about myself. I wasn't. But I was consumed with my pain. And I was consumed with crawling out of my skin. And therefore, I couldn't hear what you were saying. And I didn't care about what you were saying. Even if I wanted to, I couldn't. And really just got to the root. And she was, like I said, she was just the perfect sponsor for me to have at that time. Because she was really able to just, she just had a way of pulling it out of me and making me understand it. And that fifth step, you know, when I got to tell her, and again, it takes a higher power for me to tell anybody the truth. And I still believe that of me today. You know, it just, I need an act of God. Because first of all, I don't know the truth until I really get with God, you know, and there are so many times when I'll be like, okay, you know what, I'm just going to lie about this little thing. The other day I was going to lie to somebody about something, and I realized the reason that I was going to lie was because I didn't think that my truth was good enough. I just didn't think it was good enough. And these are the things that I get, you know, when I tell my sponsor, you know what, I was going to lie to this person, I don't know why, I don't know what was behind it, and she kind of gets to get down to the root cause of that behavior. That there's just, you know, in that case, there was an element of people-pleasing, and I didn't want to hurt the person, didn't want to let them down, and my truth just wasn't good enough. And, of course, I told the person the truth, and it wasn't that big of a deal. But that sixth step where it comes to entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character, somebody had explained the sixth and seventh step to me as the sixth step was like, I don't steal anymore, and the seventh step is, I don't want to steal anymore. And that was, you know, kind of how I understood them. And also, somebody had pointed out in the seventh step, in the one of the older versions of the Big Book, it said, humbly on our knees, ask God to remove our shortcoming. And I could get with that. I could get with the action of humbly asking God to remove my shortcomings. And I don't know why that had made such a big difference to me in the beginning, because I didn't know how to be humble in asking God to remove my shortcomings. But just adding that action of being on my knees somehow made it more tangible for me. And, of course, I had no idea what my character defects were. I didn't. And the thing of it was once I did identify my character defects, it became clear to me, like, it's not appropriate to act in these ways. The problem then was that I didn't have any behavior to replace it. So if one of my character defects is that, you know, one of them was, you know, I always felt like if I didn't like somebody, then I shouldn't act like I like them. And my first sponsor was absolutely insistent that I respect everybody, whether I liked them or I didn't like them, that I needed to be respectful towards them, no matter what they had done to me, no matter what I thought that they had done to me, I just needed to be respectful of people. And I didn't get that because I was kind of against, like, that street morale of if you don't like somebody, don't act like you like them. But I saw that. And she would show me a different way to be, and that's another thing that my sponsor really does for me today. I mean, I get stuck in situations, you know, where I'm pretty sure that the only way for me to get what I want out of a situation is to really be very aggressive and to, you know, be kind of snotty to people. And she shows me a different way to be. She shows me how to be assertive without being demeaning to another person. And again, that is something that takes somebody showing me how to do it, because I can't think of these things in my head. And throughout the years, I've had a lot of really great role models, a lot of really amazing women who have showed me how to act. And I need that. I need to see a different way of life. And I need to see that the way that I do things doesn't work. And unfortunately, sometimes that's the harder part, is really seeing that whatever the character defect is, it doesn't work, and it really, you know, ultimately harms myself and other people. And the other thing I have to get patient about with myself today is that, you know, God removes my character defects as God sees fit. I mean, there are some character defects that I would love to have removed, and they don't go away. And my sponsor points out that perhaps they don't harm anybody. You know, like, some of them are just things that, like, for my own personal reasons, I would love to just be able to correct. And I don't know. I pray, I do work, and it doesn't budge. But it is what it is. And then making a list of the persons that I have harmed, became willing to make amends to them, and making amends to the people that I have harmed. And I'm sure that, you know, we've all heard, you know, that making amends isn't about saying I'm sorry. It's about really living differently. And what I want to say about amends, and I've had a lot of really amazing experiences with amends, but I got to say that it's really been an awesome experience for me to be on the receiving end of an amends. I just made amends because I figured it was the right thing to do. Again, I was trying to kind of get closer to God. I knew I had done something to harm this person, and I needed to see them. They were a part of my life, and I just felt like I should clean it up. But the healing that has come to me through people that have made amends to me is really a phenomenal experience. just somebody saying, I know that I hurt you. I acknowledge that I hurt you. I acknowledge that I caused you pain is really just beyond words. Because there are people that harmed me, and really, I really didn't think that they cared. I didn't think it made any difference to them. And for them to come back to me and say, no, like, this is really something that I did to you that I think about. And it means a lot to me that I did this to you. So really, a lot of what goes into amends for me today is just knowing that I have the ability, and they may heal from it and they may not. And again, it's not even about what their reaction is to my amends. It is about me being able to look people in the eye and live differently and, you know, let God into that place. But it is. It's a phenomenal experience, and there's actually an amends that has been really indicated for me to make that I've been kind of balking at. But I think that it's just time for me to make the amends. And I'm kind of looking forward to it in a way, because I know that when something is hard for me, there's something that comes out on the other end. And then step 10, taking that personal inventory, and when I'm wrong, promptly admitting it, is that's just another, I love how it breaks it down in the big book. Again, it talks about, you know, when we've harmed somebody, you know, it talks about, you know, how we apologize for our mistakes and we pray and we call another alcoholic and we reach out to newcomers. And I can really get with that. That is something that, again, it's palpable to me. It's something I can grasp onto. And then that 11th step with thought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God. It's interesting because really recently, again, on Saturday, I went to this meditation meeting. And there was a person that was leading the meeting. Incidentally, it's the same person that helped me when I first got sober. It's the same man. And he ended up not staying sober after he helped me out when I first got sober. He went back to prison and he drank again multiple times. And he's been sober now for about 2 years. But he read something out of Pass It On, which was amazing to me in itself, that he actually read a book. And again, like, these are the miracles of sobriety, you know, that we can do these things. And that is not the man that I knew. And I knew him for years and years and years and years. And it was this beautiful letter between Carl Jung and Dr. Bob. And it talks about having a spiritual experience and seeking God. And what I realized that's really been lacking in my life recently is that I'm not seeking God because I really want to seek God. I've been seeking God trying to avoid pain. Like, I just know if I don't seek God, then I'm going to be in pain. And an experience that happened to me earlier that week before I heard him read that reading, where my mother was watching my sister's two dogs, and one of them is a little tiny dog, and the other one is this other dog. It's like partially blind, partially deaf, but they would follow her everywhere that she went. And I remember thinking to myself, like, I wish that I could follow God that way. I wish that I could be that excited about finding God. You know, like, these dogs were just so happy to see her all the time, would follow her to the most sordid places in the house, down to the basement, had absolute trust, absolute faith in her, just had such a pep and zeal for just being in her presence. And I just thought, I wish that could be me with finding God. And it's just not right now, you know? Like I said, I've just been, all right, I'm going to do this because, you know, if I don't hit my quota for meetings this week, I'm probably going to feel like crap. And so I was really thinking about this just last night. And again, I really realized that part of my barrier there is, again, just not feeling worthy of God's love. You know, just not having faith, not trusting, just having that doubt, like, you know what, God is going to drop me. And God just doesn't love me that much. And that hasn't been my experience in sobriety. And that's because I need to keep coming back here. Because it's very easy for me to really get into those places where it's like, God, oh yeah. You know, and for me, it's like I would be that dog who sees, like, you know, the groundhog or whatever in the field and just goes running after it, like, screw you, you know, like, I got something better going on right here. Like, that's like my relationship with God, you know, like, I'll come back to you because I need food and water and stuff, but that's about it. And I actually one of the miracles too in this program is I told you that I'd always kind of not been okay with religion, and you know, some of the meditations that I do come from people of religion, and I do it with other people that are in the rooms, and it's an amazing experience for me to do it. And it has, it's just been my experience that, you know what, like, you know, I go to meetings a lot, and I might, you know, I get to the point where it's like, I go to meetings and I don't hear anything anymore. And what I have to realize is that I might go to 3 meetings and not hear anything that anybody says and be like, I've heard this a million times, blah, 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 whatever. But it only takes 1 meeting. And if I keep going to meetings, I'm going to hear it. I'm going to hear what I need to hear. And that's why I keep coming back, because my disease can tell me, like, you really don't need to go anymore. You've heard everything that there is to hear. You know, you're going and you're just hearing blah, blah, blah. But you know what? Like, yesterday I went to a meeting and I heard some really profound things that I needed to hear. And it was about how we have a really fatal disease that kills people. And in our area, in the past, I don't know, 2 or 3 months, at least 3 people have died. And, you know, which doesn't scare me. Like, that's not enough to scare me into sobriety. But the general message that, you know what, this sobriety thing is hard. Trying to find God, that's hard. Staying here and going through the fear and talking to alcoholics, like, there's a lot of work that I have to do. And it's hard at times. But, oh, my God, it's not as hard as being out there. It's just not. It is not that hard. And the grace, like, I'm just here by grace. And I just have today. And, you know, my experience is that I have just been blessed with beautiful women. And I sponsor women. And my first sponsor, like I said, she told me right off the bat, you're selfish. And she really encouraged me to really reach out to newcomers. And that really is, I sponsored this woman. I started sponsoring her when I had about 2 years of sobriety. She was totally crazy, really crazy. And really hard to be around. She was really hard. There were people that were like, if you're hanging out with her tonight, I'm not hanging out with you because I'm not dealing with that. But she said things I couldn't say. She taught me things about myself that I didn't know. When she told these truths about herself, I knew it was okay for me to tell these truths about myself. And you know, the end of that story is she is 6 years sober today, and she's graduating from college in Chicago. And she's just this beautiful, young, sober woman. And so, you know, like, this program works in ways that I can't even begin to wrap my head around. And I just have to do it. Because my disease was going to tell me that, well, you know, I don't really see how working these steps is going to help you with this, that, and the other thing. It doesn't really seem to make any sense, but it does. And in sobriety, I went back to college. I got a bachelor's degree. I have an amazing career. And that, there was a lot of fear in that for me because I have a criminal record. And I had to go through some hoops in order to even get licensed by the state. And I knew all along that it might not even happen. But, you know, God really showed me, like, kept opening, kept giving me signs, you know, that I should stay on that route. And it took a lot of faith on my part, but I did it. I just kept going through, again, because I'm really well connected with women who kept just being in it with me and just walking with me. And it's just an amazing thing. And you know, I need to do different things in my sobriety to stay sober, you know. And I always thought that it would get boring, like eventually I would know everything that there was to know, but that's just not the truth. As I keep, and I keep going through the steps, you know, when I have a resentment, you know, my sponsor has me write it out to get to the root of what the cause is. And you know, it's true, like a lot of the times I do, I get that promise in the 4th step where it says, you know, I'll stop seeing somebody as being evil or mean or ill-willed and see somebody that's sick. And that is so much safer for me and my peace of mind. So with that, I want to thank you all so very much for having me here. And